to another episode of Internet Governance Explained, the podcast where we talk about the complexities of the digital world that shape our online lives. We're your hosts Rita Xenger and Jasper Hendricks, and today we have a fascinating episode lined up as we delve into the state of Twitter or X since the enigmatic entrepreneur Elon Musk took over the platform in 2022. In October of the same year, Musk tweeted, "The bird is freed." But how has the platform since changed? Joining us today is an expert in the field, Dr. Felix Geisbauer. Dr. Geisbauer is a postdoctoral researcher at the Weizenbaum Institute, and with a wealth of knowledge and research in this domain, Dr. Geisbauer is the perfect guy to help us navigate the shifts and changes that have occurred on Twitter or X since the entrance of Elon Musk. So let's just get into it. First off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you are connected to Twitter or X?
Sure, thank you for having me. I am, as you already said, a postdoc at the Digital News Dynamics Group at Weizenbaum Institute. And in general, I study public debate online. So most of all structural properties of public debate online, so large-scale structures in how people communicate online. I do this in a very quantitative way, mostly because my background is in physics, and I came into this field via mathematical modeling of complex systems, and then focused on network models and network analysis of public debate online. I work mostly with digital trace data, and I am also right now focusing a lot on news dynamics. So which types of news are shared online, who people comment on those news, who is receiving them, who is distributing them, and so on. But maybe a little bit as a research trajectory, I started off actually with in my PhD in Leipzig with analyses like this. And there at the Max Planck Institute for Mathematics and the Sciences, I tried to find out which users or which user groups more specifically are mostly silent in public debate online, especially on Twitter, or as it now called X. But back then, of course, this was far away from being taken over by Elon Musk. There I was focusing on these questions of which group has a larger, for example, political groups have a larger tendency to speak out, are more willing to express themselves, and which groups aren't, and how this affects what becomes visible online, basically.
So just for an audience that might not be in the sciences, could you briefly explain what digital trace data is?
Mm-hmm. Digital trace data is data that one could describe as being found online. So this is not data that scientists produce in a sense by asking people questions and then they give a reply to this, to these questions, like in a survey. It is more data that is produced, for example, by communicative acts online. If I write a reply to you on social media, I text you on WhatsApp, or I also do something in my bank account online, this produces a digital trace, and some of them are then accessible to us researchers. Some of them aren't, and you will probably get into the problems with access to digital trace data later on a little bit more. And in that sense, this is found data that has been produced as a byproduct of acts that people wanted to do online, basically. And then we can ask questions to this data that might not have been kind of anticipated before, but that might lead to useful results.
So as you're looking at large quantities of data and sort of like the whole discussion, do you think there's a big change observable on the platform pre-Musk and post-Musk?
I think there are definitely a lot of changes going on, but on different levels. So I can also, as a researcher, can speak about the perspective of research a little bit, but also most of all, of course, what most people realize is the changes that are visible for users on the platform. And I think one needs to distinguish a little bit between those two. So on the one hand, for us researchers, it has become more difficult to study what is going on the platform. And this is simply because before, when I started using Twitter as an object of research, there was an API available for us researchers where we could get a certain amount of traces of digital trace data with which we could work. And in fact, Twitter was a very interesting platform because they actually made this API better and better over time. So a couple of years ago, a new type of access for researchers was launched where we could not only like live collect tweets or look at tweets from the past in a very restricted time window, but we could also look as far in the past as we wanted in terms of when the tweets were written. So they made this better, and that led to a very strange or interesting kind of situation where there were a lot of studies about Twitter in the academic community. It was especially in comparison to how many users the platform actually had. There were far greater platforms. It was studied extremely often by researchers, and this was because this API was so conveniently accessible. At least this is one reason for it. Another reason for it is that it is a platform that is extremely visible and that is not as segregated as other platforms, for example, as Facebook or as Telegram channels, where you need to know where you're going basically in the internet to find them. Whereas on Twitter, if I type hashtag something in there, I will simply find the people that talk about hashtag something. So these two kind of elements led to this popularity among researchers. And it was decided by Twitter after the takeover of Musk that this can really go on like this. There was a lot of unpredictability in these decisions. For example, when the API access would stop, but also how the future of researchers on the platform is going to take shape. So in the beginning, it was announced that from a certain date on, we would not have access to data anymore. Then this date was postponed. So it was not only that this access stopped that was a problem for researchers, but also that we didn't really know when and how exactly the future was going to look. So the communication from the platform itself was problematic, for us at least. From a user perspective, there are also changes, of course. So the platform became, in a sense, more commercial, so that in the sense that you could buy these blue checks, so you could become a verified user by paying. And a certain pressure was put on people to also pay for this, so especially official institutions, for example, and also like users that want a lot of reach, they kind of need this blue check. And also there seems to be a little bit of a different treatment to users that have this compared to others, so you have more reach. But also there have been certain studies that show that if you have this blue check, most of the problematic content that you post might not get removed. And this these studies probably need a little bit more consolidation, but it's also harder for us to study Twitter right now because we don't have access to this. And one big change, of course, that has been talked about a lot and that is very severe is changes in moderation policy. So moderation is not that strict anymore. Certain people were allowed back on the platform that had been banned before because they had posted, for example, hateful content. Donald Trump is a good example, even though he decided against using Twitter again, even though his account got reinstated, he's not tweeting anything anymore, he now has his own platform. But also other examples of, for example, really right-wing actors, they were allowed back on the platform because Elon Musk proclaimed commitment to free speech that he wanted to reinstate on the platform. And now apparently Twitter has this new moderation policy that has kind of three blocks. One is that certain content might just be perfectly fine. They will not delete this. And then before, of course, problematic or hateful content that was illegal also was deleted. They still do this. They say they delete illegal content. But there is a kind of a third block now in between those two where they say free speech but not reach. So that certain content might be hateful, but they still leave it on the platform. It's just not that easily discoverable anymore. Which is kind of how they define this compromise between free speech and issues that come with everything being able to be voiced. And this is kind of the third block of their strategy right now, which is unclear how this is gonna affect the platform basically. But this is a big change, of course, in the moderation policies of the platform, and also a lot of staff has been laid off. So we don't really know how effective and how fast moderation is working on the platform. These are like the big changes that I am aware of. Of course, the situation is dynamic. As I said, Twitter is not really reliable, or X is not really reliable at the moment, in the sense that what they are announcing might or might not be kind of visible on the platform quickly or take effect. So we have to see how this is evolving.
So Twitter has always been a platform where a lot of policymakers lead discourse or also decision makers, and I think X is still that platform. I mean, I guess a lot of people are giving it up, but there's not really that many or that strong alternatives in that sense. Mm-hmm. Would you say that as there has been a lot of deregulation on the platform, as you know, do you think there's a lot of real life consequences to this, especially as it is a platform of like policymakers and decision makers?
Yeah, this is really hard to say. So in terms of real life consequences, what first comes to mind is if certain personal or private data gets leaked on the platform, this might be, people might be able to do this more easily on the platform now. The moderation policies are relaxed in the sense also that this might not lead to user bans or the tweets get deleted more slowly. So this definitely has real life consequences. In terms of opinion leaders, yeah, I see a tendency at least that some people might leave the platforms, but others also come back that are influential. So this might just not decrease the reach of the platform, but more the crowd that is using it a lot. And it might definitely lead to a fragmentation of debate in the sense that certain users are just on different platforms now. And before, one of the big advantages of Twitter that was always kind of argued with was that you are one click away of discussing with someone with a very different point of view on certain issues, and it might be that just, yeah, in a certain sense the user base gets more homogeneous. But also this is a research question, of course, but there are alternatives popping up, some of them successful, some of them not. So Mastodon, Blue Sky, Threads, they are all new services. The hype around Mastodon is a little bit over. Blue Sky is also decreasing in terms of activity, I think, or at least in terms of new users joining the platform. So the invite codes that were a really big thing that everybody was trying to get are now lying around, and people don't have new customers basically for those. But it is, for example, quite interesting that on Blue Sky, certain groups that don't feel comfortable on Twitter anymore or on X now are joining the platform. So for example, LGBTQ plus groups are very often there. Certain language groups or people from a certain cultural background have large communities there. So they might just, yeah, produce debates there and talk more on this platform than on X. So yeah, this fragmentation might become an issue or is already an issue now.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, maybe it's not an issue, but also a possibility if it's not so centralized on debates on the internet are not so centralized on like three platforms. Although, I mean, I imagine for researchers, it's a lot better if you have one platform where everything happens, where you can just focus on. Because I really want to get back quickly to the point you made about the access to data that is not possible that easily anymore because there's not really an API anymore. So we're all excited that the DSA is going to come into effect in February now. Are you optimistic that with Article 40 and the data access possibilities that you're going to get back some Twitter access data?
I'm optimistic that some people might be able to use the platform again, and I think the DSA is really forceful tool for this, but it also has a lot higher standards than the ones that were previously needed to get access to platforms. So there they have this notion of systemic risk, and this is actually something that is a condition on having access to a very specific type of data that you then have to flesh out. So you need to exactly state what type of data you want and why this is important to battle systemic risk in the European Union, which is anyway, apparently, in terms of public debate, not a very well-defined concept yet. I think it is more well-defined in terms of, for example, for banks. Systemic risk has been in the conversation there for a long time. But now everything there is very, very new, and it will take a little bit of time, I think, that the conditions for getting access to data on the grounds of, for example, systemic risk are clear for everyone and are also available for everyone. So now it is just we have to apply. You have to apply, for example, for X access, and then you wait and you don't really know what you can expect. And it also puts a little bit more pressure on us researchers because we have to have a strong, very, very clear research agenda from the start, which might just decrease certain findings that become very interesting that you cannot anticipate beforehand. And also certain data storage conditions need to be stated very clearly, which is, of course, important that you respect privacy of users and so on if you collect certain types of data. But for small groups, if one person wants to analyze Twitter data, for example, this is also quite resource intensive, basically, to work all this out on their own. So yeah, I guess large research institutes will soon have quite decent access to certain types of data, but also the research questions will be more narrow now because they need to address the systemic risk. You cannot just say, I want to analyze public debate around TV shows in Germany. This is not going to work out, which is kind of decreasing the diversity of research questions that you can ask.
And otherwise, I mean, just to clarify, if there is no API, that means the type of data you can get is basically public data that we can all see if we go to the platform.
So with the API before, it was only for the case of Twitter or X, it was also only public data that we could get there. So we were not able to look at direct messages or something, of course. And now I think it depends. I mean, if you would, so for example, with respect to algorithms or with respect to certain types of behavior that might not be completely publicly visible on platforms, if it contributes to systemic risk, you might be able to take a look at this. Yeah, but I have to say I'm not really 100%. I think this is in the DSA, but I would have to look it up again. So maybe, yeah, but I think you could even take a look at certain things that you were not able to take a look on beforehand, because then the platform was just what you got through the API, and now you have a specific request in terms of if this and this content doesn't get filtered out, is a systemic risk. So I might be able to study parts of the platform that were not visible before.
I don't think it's standardized yet from the European Union side. I mean, what you said, like, it's not really clear.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like, the GDPR and privacy regulations are still in place.
Yeah.
So personal data or any private messages could not be accessed.
Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, we got a little bit off track now with all the data stuff. I want to pick up on a study that you published in 2021. It's called Ideological Differences in Engagement in Public Debate on Twitter. Would you be able to just summarize it briefly for us?
Yes, so with respect to this study, we were interested in observing public debate on Twitter on two very specific examples, and in regional case studies. So one was the state election in Saxony that was taking place in 2019, and we collected users, politicians mostly, that were on the electoral lists. We checked if they had a Twitter account, and then we collected all of the tweets that they wrote, but also all interactions with them of other users. And additionally, we looked at media accounts from Saxony, journalists that were writing on the state election, and other activists that were important in the debate around these elections. And then there was also a spontaneous incident at New Year's Eve in 2019 in Leipzig, where there were riots, so a clash between the police and some people that were mostly left-wing groups in Konnewitz. And with these two case studies, we were looking at who is actually debating there. So who is talking to whom, who is replying to these important politicians, to these important political figures, who is debating with each other. This was kind of the case study focus. But behind this, there was a more general question that is important, always important when you deal with digital trace data. So you deal with data that you find online. This is usually a lot of data, so you just see how many people are interacting on Twitter, for example, on these issues. And you think that this is basically a mirror of how people think in a society. That's at least when you start dealing with digital trace data what you might think. But in fact, of course, this sample is heavily biased. Like, there are specific groups that are more active and specific groups, for example, that are less active on these platforms for different reasons. So we wanted to find out whether there were activity differences in this data that we collected that we could still make visible on the basis of digital trace data. So normally I would ask people on the street if they are on Twitter maybe, or in a survey if they are on Twitter, that with a representative sample, for example, then I can make a claim about how many people are even on the platform. But then I'm also interested in how many people of different political views are actually active on there, and if there is a bias to one or the other side here, for example. And now there comes together this role of Twitter as this big kind of town hall that we already talked a little bit before, so that there are like important people on the platform that are very visible, that are discussing on there, and that it is also visible for a silent observer. So if I don't have a Twitter account back then, if I didn't have a Twitter account, I could just go on the platform, read everything, and then a certain opinion picture would be visible to me. So I would see, I would search for the Saxon election, and I would just read all, for example, tweets of the Ministerpräsident of Saxony and who replied to them, and I would think, yeah, okay, the opinion on the platform is critical of him or positive towards him because I read all of these tweets. But of course, you don't only have to be on the platform, but you also need to be willing to write such a tweet so that it becomes visible below, for example, Michael Kretschmer and his tweets. So in this kind of mass of data, you need to make these kind of large-scale patterns visible, and we were looking for a method to do this. And what we found was that if you look at the people who share certain content of, for example, different political parties in this election, And then you look for whether they actually wrote a comment or one tweet, one reply to at least one reply to one of these politically active users or to one of the users that are discussing these issues about this election, for example. Then you see a large difference. So in terms of political leaning of users, at least estimated political leaning, very many people compared to the other sides were retweeting left content, basically. So parties SPD, left, or the Greens in this election, whereas retweeting behavior on the right and on the right wing was not that pronounced. So there were a lot fewer users that were actually sharing content of these part of the part, for example, of the AfD or of Pegida. On the other hand, if you have now users that you at least have an estimation of what probably their political leaning is, and then you look at whether they write replies to others, whether they are not only retweeting, because this is kind of a an easy thing to do, only your followers see what you retweet, so this you don't need to fear that you clash with others, that you have to debate others on this. But if you see who is actually debating with others, then the probability that someone from that had shared, for example, the content of the AfD would discuss with others was more than twice as high than of someone from the left side of the spectrum, basically. So there we saw that even on the platform, there are differences in terms of which users are more active, are more willing to express their opinion, and others who aren't. And there are actually systematic differences in terms of which parties these users follow, these users retweet actually in that case. And this is something that you should always keep in mind if you look at this vast amount of data that you see online as a researcher, but also as a user. You can parse through as many replies, as many tweets, as many posts as you want. This can always be biased in some way. This is never an accurate representation of the general population, but also not even of the users of a platform. And this is... yeah, this is what we wanted to show in the study, and this is something that I think also for research, this it took a while that this kind of became a general kind of people acknowledged this as a restriction of digital trace data, because in the beginning, in the early 2010s, people were just excited about this new opportunity and they thought this is going to replace polls, this is going to replace everything. But of course, it's just produced under very specific circumstances, basically, and you have to take that into account.
But then in the early 2010s, the amount of data was a lot less. So do you think that also influenced? I guess like there's also a lot of bots on Twitter, and at least that's what we keep hearing. So do you think that also influenced that type of research in a way?
I think bots are sometimes an issue, but and of course you can never really, really know, especially on X, that is really fastly changing as a platform. It is hard to keep track of how many bots are on there, how many what content is automated, what content isn't. But when it comes to these political debates, we hand-checked a couple of users, we checked the content that they were tweeting, and at least to us, it seemed like the bot activity was negligible for this study. And in general, I think online environments... so it is always easy to say that something that seems, for example, problematic online is induced by bots. But there are also other explanations for example, that some users are more active than others. For example, that these online environments give people that have the feeling, at least, that they are not able to speak out in public normally, that they can voice their opinions there. And in a certain sense, we tied this then to the concept of counter-public spheres that was a very popular kind of notion throughout the 90s and also the 2000s in terms of progressive movements, that these could voice their opinion there and challenge the kind of hegemonic structures in certain spaces. But of course you can tie this to any kind of political movement, and sometimes there are online environments that just are very suitable for these people to voice their opinion. And I think these comment sections or these reply sections on Twitter or X or also in other social media are just very suitable to voice criticism, to challenge what they perceive as hegemonic. And that is how I explain these activity differences, for example. And in terms of bot activity in general, I think it always depends heavily on the platform, whether bots even have a strong impact on, for example, public opinion, or what information is circulated or what information isn't, I would say.
So as you've investigated two separate events during your study, one which was an election, which is a very planned event.
Yeah.
So people know upfront, like, for a long time this is going to happen, and then one very spontaneous event. Was there any difference in the type of discourse that you found on the platform?
In general, the large-scale patterns that we analyzed were, yeah, interestingly, extremely close to each other. So in terms of willingness of opinion expression, these two debates basically mirrored each other. So there was not a big difference there. People that were retweeting a lot of AFD content were very active in both cases compared to others. But you could see in terms of shares and in terms of retweet that this spontaneous event in Konnewitz had a very dynamic component to it. So the election was slowly building up. People were retweeting quite as you would expect them to. So people were retweeting the same user in August or at the end of August that they would retweet in the beginning of August, for example. Whereas in terms of Konnewitz, there was one politician that was live tweeting about what was happening on New Year's Eve, basically. And this tweet was the first one that was spread throughout kind of this political Twitter sphere, basically, or this regional political Twitter sphere, at least. And that was extremely influential. Many people replied to it, many people positioned themselves to it. So there was really these one or two or three tweets that kind of set forth this whole motion of events on Twitter. So that was a difference, and the debate was also more dynamic, I would say. So there was, for example, if you look at who retweeted whom early on in this debate, for 1 week there was a politician from the Greens very close to the kind of region of right-wing politicians because he had tweeted something that was in favor of how the police acted. And then many people that had retweeted also content from, for example, the right part of the CDU were also retweeting him. And this chaired in the overall picture, so after like 2 or 3 weeks, this evened out and the user ended up where it had been during the election, basically. But yeah, and this very, very dynamic development, you sometimes see these interesting dynamics, basically.
So in 2024, we have a lot of elections coming. So some big countries like India, the United States, Indonesia, Mexico, South Africa are going to hold elections, as well as the European Union. What are your sort of like predictions, or what are your thoughts on how public debate is going to be held in terms of these elections on, let's say, X maybe, to make it a little bit smaller?
This is a very big question to answer. But probably it is even a little bit easier to answer in the big picture than on X. So for example, I already talked about the content moderation that is changing on X, of course. This probably means that there will be a lot more extreme content that is not taken down from the start, basically, on the platform, even though they claim that at least this won't have a lot of reach then. But the content is still on the platform, so this will probably have an effect. The other effect that we talked about already is that maybe discussions will take place on different platforms and people will not clash that much anymore. So especially for certain countries, there might be a part of the population that is on a different platform than the other, and then these users just don't directly interact that much anymore. But of course, we are talking about democratic elections here, and this the interrelation between social media and democratic systems, trust in democracy, trust in politicians and so on, is extremely complex. And we are still in the beginning of trying to understand what actually is going on there. I'm also not aware of many studies that try to really paint this big picture. There is one by Philipp Lorenz-Spreen and colleagues, who did a review of very many studies that looked at this relation for different countries between certain democratic values, certain democratic systems, and social media. And what they found is, at least as a general tendency, you can see that social media can serve as a space where people can voice opinions that are not the mainstream, obviously, but also that might challenge, for example, semi-authoritarian or authoritarian regimes, and that it is generally, there is a positive correlation between democratic values, for example, and social media in such countries where you have at least semi-authoritarian structures, whereas for established democracies, they tend to form more of a threat, basically. So maybe political trust decreases because of social media, because you have an information overload, because people don't really know who they want to believe anymore, and so on. So in the big picture, there are these two tendencies, basically. Which is why I wouldn't think that debate on social media in countries where there are democratic elections soon will all of a sudden become extremely healthy and Habermasian, basically. But yeah, it is hard to predict X's role also, especially on this, is going to be, except for the fact that maybe soon we're going to read newspaper articles where they are not saying, this politician said this on X, but politician Y said it on platform Blue Sky, whereas politician Z said it on X. So yeah, this could definitely become a factor and might also make journalistic work more stressful because you have to monitor all these different platforms now.
Yeah, we've already mentioned a little bit the different platforms that sort of like emerged after the changes on X. Do you think there's one runner-up as like the new platform for political discourse?
So what I perceive as someone who has tried to use these platforms a little bit and is not really convinced by any of them, but also I'm not really a big active user on X as well. I just have my account there because I needed it for data access and because I want to see what's going on actually there. Yeah, I think Mastodon had a little bit of an architectural problem, especially as a replacement for Twitter or X, because it has this fragmented kind of architecture already built into it, which is for a variety of reasons, of course, also nice that you have certain communities that have certain moderation practices that have include certain users that do not always directly interact, but it also makes growth of a platform and reach kind of, it's just a problem for this. Blue Sky, as I already said, is also interesting because it is a space that was, especially I think because they had this very restricted growth policy in terms of that you would have to be on the platform to invite others and then you only had a certain amount of invite code, so that it grew basically slower than a normal platform would do if you had just have unrestricted access to it. That this was growth maybe in a certain direction of the platform. So as I said, certain marginalized groups went there very early and made it their space. And for them, I think it is still a valuable and interesting platform. For scientists, for example, I think I followed a couple of people there and now I checked their profiles again and they haven't posted anything for 10, for 15, for 20 days. So yeah, they also realize maybe that they go back to X or they go back to another platform, but it's not for everyone there, I would say. Just because you don't have the critical mass for different types of communities there. And yeah, Threads, I mean, is at least tied to a very big social media platform already. I also see them, for example, being aggressively marketed on Instagram, so you can always just, you're one click away and then you're over there. But I do not really have a feeling on how this is going to evolve in the future, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe we'll need a lot more cross-platform studies after all.
Yeah, which will be very difficult to... Like, the data everywhere looks very different from each platform. What you get, what types of affordances the platform has. I mean, all of this is just so different that I don't think you can ever really compare them because just, on the one platform you can directly reply to users, on the other one the whole mechanism of interaction is different. Or you have TikTok, where the platform just functions completely different than from other platforms. So this fragmentation is definitely something that is also going to concern research a lot in the future, I think.
Yeah, I guess platform researchers are not going to get bored anytime soon.
For sure.
Thank you so much for coming and for taking the time
Thank you
to
for
answer
inviting
all the questions.
Me.
It was very insightful.
Yes.